Hi, this is Chuck Shravick for Millennium Group News. I'm a broadcaster. I've been in broadcasting for 30 years, about 20 years here in Houston, Texas. And for a long time, I've known our government has been lying to us about various topics, the JFK assassination, Watergate, radiation experiments, the very existence of the National Security Agency, the NSA, UFOs. That's a whole other topic we could get into sometime. Of course, they're lying about those things. But for years, I trusted NASA. NASA wouldn't lie to us, I thought, growing up as a kid watching Neil Armstrong on the moon. What would NASA have to hide? Surely all of the scientific things they discovered and the scientists of our time, surely all the things they discovered they would openly talk about. Well, no. To my shock, I am finding out there's a whole political correctness at NASA and the scientific community. There are things that we are not told about. I guarantee you that if you listen to what is about to transpire, you're going to be stunned, you're going to be shocked, you're going to be mad, you're going to be amazed. About 30 years ago, when I first started broadcasting, there was a group called the Fire Sign Theater, and I love those guys. They were so funny. They're still around and so truthful. And one of the things they said that caught me, and the phrase still sticks in my mind today, and it's everything we know is wrong. And more it's appearing that, my God, it might be that way. On the line from Minnesota with me right now, a man you're going to find just absolutely fascinating, Jim McCanny. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Hi, Chuck.
And Jim used to teach at Cornell University. Cornell University. The hallowed halls where Carl Sagan taught astronomy. Jim, you were there at the same time. Tell me, what was your function there, and what got you tossed out of Cornell?
Well, I was actually what you might call a low-level faculty member there. I was probably one of the few people that did not have a PhD. I went there originally to Ithaca with a girlfriend who was studying foreign language. She had a fellowship to study foreign languages. And at that time, I had a master's degree in physics and had taught extensively prior to that. And when we were there, I thought, well, you know, I should go over to Cornell and just see if I can get my PhD here. So I went over and I filled out the applications. And when I went in to talk to the chairman of the physics department, he looked over my resume and he said, well, I tell you what, we don't have any openings. We're booked up. You know, we're backlogged for a couple years. Very hard to get into this school in physics. But you can teach here. We have some openings, and you actually could teach some of our physics courses. And I just about fell off my chair. And when I got back up, I said, okay. So I was, you know, with my teaching background and having taught, you know, introductory mathematics and physics for quite some time, I obviously I was had the teaching capability, so I accepted that. And in the course of the first few months there, I had been working for many years, actually, since I had been out of college in the early 70s. And I worked on a problem in physics, which is an unsolved problem. It's called the n-body problem. And it's unsolved in everywhere from quantum mechanics, which is the physics of subatomic particles.
Yeah, run that word by me again. The what body problem?
The n-body problem. That means you have more than two things. You have one, two, and n, meaning many bodies, and it could be atoms in a matrix. It could be a number of celestial bodies in a celestial mechanics problem. But the problem in physics is that we can solve fairly simple things analytically, that is, with equations. And so when you put a time factor in of, say, 10 million years from now, you can tell exactly in 10 million years where those two particles would be. But you throw a third one in there, and all of a sudden things go haywire.
It screws things up.
Because the orbits are not repetitive. And so it really messes things up. And of course, you got something like a solar system with one sun, and you've got 9 planets and lots of moons and thousands, if not millions, of asteroids. And then you've got things like dust falling around and little collisions going on. And really, it's very difficult to solve this problem. Also, the fact that you would have to know exactly the velocity and positions of all of these things even to begin working this problem. So the Russians had worked statistically on this problem and had a lot of statistical results. And so I was working on my own, just looking at the possibility of solving these analytically. And what I noticed in my calculations was that I was working with mainly celestial mechanics. And what I did, just for fun, was I threw in electrical and magnetic fields. And I didn't know at the time how they were formed, but what it gave me was a basic understanding of the shapes of the fields that would occur when you start to combine these electric fields of various objects out in outer space, what they would look like and what they would act like.
Yeah. Now, as I understand it, Jim, currently, astronomers, when they're calculating the positions of the planets and various other objects in the solar system, are only using what they call Newtonian mechanics to do that, and only taking into account the force of gravity.
That's correct.
And now does this electrical magnetic phenomenon you're talking about throw those calculations off?
In certain instances, it's very interesting because many times they don't come into play. And this is part of the understanding that I gained from working on this particular problem theoretically, was by the time I hit the reality of the solar system and the data that was coming in from the spacecraft, which I had access to at Cornell, I realized that I was seeing what my theoretical work was predicting. And so only in very unusual situations at that time were they actually recorded. And you had to look at a combination of electric and magnetic fields. And, of course, there were no such things as electrical detectors. And people had enough foresight to put what they called magnetic detectors on the spacecraft. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. But so they would detect, for example, when the Voyager spacecraft went by a small moon at Saturn, it detected a tremendously high gravitational force and at the same time a very high magnetic force. But there was a combination of things there, and what the large magnetic field was, it was not due to the object, it was due to the electrical current that was passing by that object as part of a larger scale current sheet that occurs around Saturn.
Jim, what caught my attention to your work so stunningly, I'm just a backyard ooh-ah kind of guy that looks through my telescope, and I take pictures occasionally. My pictures cause some controversy, like when I took of the Hale-Bopp comet, when I suspected that NASA and big observatories were covering up the good pictures, I started my own observations. But Jim, ever since I was a little kid, it mystified me how comets, which I always learned were just kind of like dirty snowballs, I always wondered, how is it after billions and millions of years of circling the sun that there's any ice left when the tails flare off every time? And I was told even they lose a couple percent of their ice every time. And even in my little 12-year-old mind at the time, I was able to calculate, well, gee, they should all be burned up by now. Now, you have a theory of comets that explains why they're still around that goes against the grain, but it makes so darn much sense. Tell me about it, please.
Well, okay, just a quick comment on the ice ball model, or the what they call the dirty snowball model.
Oh, that's what got you in trouble at Cornell, right?
Oh, yeah. In that case, see, and in the many, many cases of what you might call modern theorizing regarding space science, there are things that are invented that we can never detect. And in this case, there's a thing called the Oort cloud, which is a alleged ring of comets. Now, supposedly all the comets formed in the inner solar system here with everything else, but then they somehow magically got moved out to a place where we can't see them.
Called the Oort cloud.
We will never be able to see them, and it's called the Oort cloud. And allegedly, a star comes by or something big comes by way out there once every million years and kicks a few of them around, and a few of them come floating into our solar system.
I've even heard it called the Death Star, the Dark Star, things like that.
Right, but you know, the amazing thing is it's this invisible thing that we'll never be able to detect. And so you have theories whose origins are based on error. You know, they're unprovable.
It's just an explanation they came up with to explain what seems to be happening.
Right, and that's good. You can do that, but when you create something that can never be detected, then you have a problem because you can't prove your theory, and neither can anybody else disprove it. So everybody sits around, and you, the group that's in power at the time is the one that gets publications.
Yeah, things haven't changed much since Galileo, have they?
No. No, man. Not at all. But your question originally, I got sidetracked a little bit there. You asked me about the new comet model, which actually isn't so new. It's over 20 years old at this point, regarding how the tails form and that type of thing.
Yeah, why is it they're still here? Why haven't they all melted by now?
Well, that's a good question. And just to throw in a couple of dichotomies, the moon supposedly now has water on it. Well, if you can get water to sublimate, which is the condition where it goes from a solid to a gaseous state without going to liquid water in the middle, then that supposedly was what's going on with these dirty snowballs. And you can form this incredibly large tail, which is sometimes 10 million miles across, and like with Hale-Bopp, 400 million miles long. That's like twice the distance from Earth to the Sun. That's how long that tail was.
Hale-Bopp, 400 million long tail.
Yeah.
That's almost out to Jupiter, isn't it?
Yeah. It was enormous. Absolutely enormous. And this comet, Hale-Bopp, was, which NASA claims it never took a picture of,
well, I've seen maybe half a dozen Hubble pictures.
Right, very early on, and then they shut the door on the release of data because very early on they realized that their dirty snowball model was totally incorrect, and they had a problem. They had a theoretical problem in that if the comets were not dirty snowballs and melting away and going away, and my model was correct, that the comet, in fact, was like a huge vacuum cleaner and sucking this tail material into it and becoming bigger, then they had a problem with, it's like a domino effect of the theories. They just tumbled one after the other. And the common story that they give for how the solar system formed is it all formed 4.5 billion years ago from the swirling dust cloud, and nothing has happened since. And so if all of a sudden these comets are coming in and becoming planets, then their story of how the solar system formed is all wrong.
Well, wait a minute. You're saying that planets are formed by comets?
Yeah, and that's exactly what's going on. And that's why none of the Hale-Bopp data was released, because they, for example, with the Very Large Array, radio telescope out in the desert, out in the southwestern desert, NASA scientists measured the internal temperature of the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, and that data is classified.
NASA is supposed to be an open agency.
Oh, no, not at all. There's nothing open. The things that you hear about NASA are, you know, where they're touting, they're blowing their horn, those come out of a public release agency, and those are meant to excite you and cause you to keep sending them money.
Yeah. Well, now, what exactly are they? Is this just a case of scientific egos not wanting to be wrong, or are there some deeper and more nefarious reasons you think they're hiding? For instance, what's really going on with comets?
Well, the first reason is very huge. You have to understand these scientists have immense egos. When you say get your PhD and you're hired at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center as a young PhD intern, or you are hired at Cornell or Harvard or JPL or any of the other places there or even around the world, you tend to have a pretty little pumped up ego there, you know.
Yeah.
And so now you and all your friends and all the theories you've learned and all the textbooks you've written articles for and all of this, all your journal publications are all linked together. All of a sudden, you find your theories crumbling underneath your feet. There's a huge, and this is what has happened, is they've always come up with a new explanation, and the list of contradictions now, if you go through the standard explanations for snowball comets or for how the planets formed, or, for example, if all of Jupiter's moons formed at the same time, why are they totally different? Why some are covered with ice and oceans, and others are covered with sulfur dioxide and volcanic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a few little items.
I love it. Such common sense questions. Yeah.
If you look at the solar system, there's no way this stuff formed all at the same time. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Now, you guys, and when I refer to you guys, I mean the Millennium Group. And the web page and the various information that you've collected, you are saying that right now there is a new member of our solar system.
Yeah, and we think that on they are the two comets that came in. Actually, there's three. There's two that are skirting the sun, in near the sun, inside the orbit of Mercury. And we think they might be the comets that came in. And one caused that tremendous solar explosion as it passed through a solar flare just as the comet came through and ignited that portion of the sun. The huge solar flare came off, and of course NASA says, oh, totally unrelated.
Well, yeah, comets are only a few miles wide. The sun is millions or would hold millions of Earths.
Yeah. And so how could this little ice ball come by and cause this big explosion? So, of course, they say, unrelated. Well, no, it was very related in that they're sitting there, and you ask, is there a reason why they're sitting on the fact that they know now, and they know well within these inner circles, these people know they're wrong. I will tell you that right now.
And that's what
they know. They're wrong. They're hiding it. They're trying to manipulate it. In a normal scenario, they would allow themselves some time to kind of I call it the creeping crud. They would change things, and all of a sudden, what was white last year would be black this year, and what was black last year would be white this year, and nobody would be any the wiser, and NASA would go on. But they have a little problem in that. We are not letting them do it this time.
Now, there is a satellite out there called SOHO, mm-hmm. which is observing the sun, in fact, which is the source of the information about these new comets and what have you. And there's been some very mysterious shutting the thing down and coming back online and shutting it down and coming back online.
Yeah.
They say for various problems, but you think they're covering something up.
Well, we know they are, and we know what they're covering up, and we've seen it. And this comes back to the new solar system objects. The two comets that came in, I believe it was maybe April, and then it was shortly thereafter that a lot of funny business started going on with the SOHO people. And you have to understand there's many levels of administration, you might call it, in this hierarchy of people who get to see this data. We're in conjunction with the European Space Organization and in SOHO, and what has happened is the NSA, National Security Agency, has a level above NASA, and all the NASA scientists have had to sign what is equivalent to a non-disclosure agreement. All of the information that comes out of NASA has to be filtered before it can be released to the public. And what they're using is a Monroe Doctrine type of principle here. And what it amounts to is anything that could cause a public scare must be prevented from being let out. In other words, they don't want people to know if there's an asteroid that's going to crash into Earth.
But this is not a danger to the Earth, is it, these new objects?
No. But in a sense, there's something going on here. Now, just recently, scientists have discovered many G-type stars, the type of star that our sun is, and they are nova, going through a nova spontaneously, and they're sitting there. They look just like our sun from a distance.
Well, that's not supposed to happen with a star like the sun, is it?
No. And, of course, in the NASA release, they said about 10 times every other line was it couldn't happen here. Those two little comets that are buzzing around the sun right now, in that big flare that it let off, it caused the sun to ignite there. Those are exactly the things that can cause a star to nova. And see, it comes back to the theories that are being presented today. Another thing you'll find on our webpage is a long series of commentaries regarding what we call the standard solar model, which is also totally incorrect. That's the one where supposedly this gas and dust cloud collapsed and the pressure on the inner part of the star gained enough temperature to where it ignited the fusion process, and then it takes maybe a million years for the light energy to be transmitted out of this dense, highly packed inner core to the outer area where we see it as this 6,000 degree yellow ball.
Yeah.
Well, that story is totally incorrect. We know.
Jim, excuse me. Let me back you up for just a second here. Before we get into solar system theory,
yes.
and a question I have about comets, and just maybe kind of a layman's translation here so far. I know that inside an electron, the nucleus is tremendously bigger than the electron spinning around it.
Oh, you mean in an atom?
In an atom.
Right.
The nucleus is tremendously bigger mass-wise. Is this kind of what we're talking about, even though these comets are tiny size-wise, they carry charges that are electrical charges that are enormous compared to what the sun might carry?
Well, let's stop here and just in about a 2 or 3 minute span here explain what a comet really is, and then a lot of this will start to make sense.
Okay.
What the sun is doing and what I realized early on in my theoretical work, because I was seeing these electrical phenomena in the NASA data that was coming in from Voyager and Pioneer spacecraft. What was clear is there were electric fields and there were electric currents. And, you know, if you think for a minute...
Didn't they measure electricity around Saturn that...
Yes.
Was incredibly stronger than they expected?
Yeah, billions of volts of lightning with millions of amps of current flowing down the rings towards the planet.
Gee.
And they looked down and off of both Jupiter and Saturn, one of the kind of unmentioned things they saw were proton winds. In other words, there's a wind of protons coming off both Jupiter and Saturn. Well, they're supposed to be planets, not star-like things. So anyway, what I did is I put all this information together and I said, these guys are acting, Jupiter and Saturn, that is, are acting like little stars. They have the property of stars, but they don't have enough mass to have kicked off the fusion process like our standard solar model says. So what that told me is that there's another cause of fusion. Now, there might be that dense core, but let me just talk about the properties of stars. And what I realized that there had to be a mechanism, a charge-separating mechanism in the fusion process occurring in stars. And what it was doing and what it had to be doing, because I knew the end effect from my theoretical work, what it had to be doing was pumping out an excess current of protons as opposed to electrons, and we know there's the solar wind coming off the sun. But the standard story has always been, well, space is electrically neutral, so there's got to be the same number of electrons as protons.
Yeah.
And so it was very early on that I realized the source of this electrical power was the sun. In fact, we know now that the sun puts out far more electrical power than it does power in the form of visible light.
So we are living in a very electrically charged solar system.
That is absolutely correct.
Enormous electrical charges on various bodies.
And the thing is, though, like I said before, you have to understand how these things work before, because scientists many times have tried to include magnetic and electric fields, and they fumbled all over them because they didn't understand the subtleties of how they work.
Jim, I know one of the things that you said that just fascinated me, and I want you to go over it again, and that is the idea that tails of comets are not stuff coming off of the comet, but stuff coming into the comet.
Yeah, basically a comet is a cosmic vacuum cleaner, and here's how it works. And you can, in fact, you can set up a little demonstration. I did it a couple times for high school students, which amazes me, because you can do this and you can show kids and they understand, but you can't take a NASA PhD scientist and show them, mainly because he doesn't want to see it.
Uh-huh.
It's too scary an item here. But
well, were there not some priests who refused to look through Galileo's telescope?
Yeah, and when he was at the Leaning Tower of Pisa and the crowd gathered below for the afternoon demonstration and his students were there and he dropped the two balls, the one large one and the one small one, and they hit the ground at the same time, the professors of the college there disbanded. They walked away muttering to themselves and continued to teach their incorrect scientists, and that's what's going on here today.
Yeah, today, to this day, they're still doing it.
Yeah, the human personality is quite interesting. I don't think we've grown since then.
No. Anyway, back to comets actually drawing the tail in and not spitting it out.
Okay, yeah, so here's the situation. The sun is expelling an excess current of protons. It can't do that forever because you'd have this enormous charge buildup and it would have to stop at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
So the charge separation is a natural byproduct of fusion. And so eventually there has to be somewhere a return current sheet to bring back this and somewhat balance this solar system electrically. And in fact, there is a current sheet. It comes down the magnetic tail of the sun. That's at least one of them, and we think there's probably other current sheets out there also that we haven't fully understood and detected yet. But what happens is you build up a capacitor, but with the sun negatively charged in the center and this nebular cloud that sits out there. Now, you have to understand, too, the solar wind sweeps stuff out of the solar system. We know that. And that was part of the reason for them thinking that the snowball tail material was being swept away.
Right.
Because of the solar wind.
The solar wind was always, the tails of comets always face away from the sun, right?
Yeah, and so that was one of the common properties. But so we know that it sweeps stuff out. So now if you have stuff sitting out there kind of being held back by this wind in all directions in this three-dimensional sphere that sits way out beyond the orbit of Pluto, And the solar wind is holding it back, and of course that comes in and out depending on the strength of the solar wind. So anyway, now you have a capacitor. Okay, now let's bring some kind of asteroidal body, just a rock, not a snowball, doesn't have to have ice in it. It comes in, and it comes in to and breaks through that capacitor. It's coming in. Now, the thing that I like to use as an example that everybody can understand is the backyard bug killer. You've seen those, got a fluorescent tube in the middle.
Oh, yeah, and they make the zapping sound when the bugs go in.
When the bug goes in. Well, the bug's a little comet, in a sense. It's doing the same thing a comet does.
Uh-huh.
He flies between the grid, that's a capacitor, and the capacitor does not discharge without the bug there. What does the bug do? When he first flies in through the outer grid, which is at ground potential, and you have the outside at ground and not the high voltage, so we don't all kill ourselves with these devices, you know. But anyway, the outside grid or screen is at ground potential, and then, of course, we have a high voltage grid inside of that. And it doesn't discharge until the bug flies in. When the bug flies in at ground potential, he's dragging that ground potential in with him. And as he does, as he flies in perpendicular to that mesh and towards the other one, he's now extending that ground potential out like a little finger. And what you have to understand is his electrical size is much bigger than his physical size. And so now we get into a thing where we're talking, and this has to deal with comets and their size relative to the nucleus. Comets are huge, but the nucleus is little. And what they're doing when they come in on a elliptical orbit is they're cutting through that capacitor of the sun, just like the bug's doing with the bug killer, and they discharge the capacitor. Now the physical size of the comet nucleus and its electrical size, which is called the Debye shielding distance, are totally different items.
So this is why a little teeny comet, and I saw the NASA animation, the NASA video, little teeny comet, huge, crashes into the sun, and there's a huge solar flare.
Right, and so this is what happened. The comet was an electrical discharge, and the flare itself is a streamer that is a streamer that's unusually large with an unusually high number of protons going out from the sun. And so you already have a discharge sitting there, and the comet comes through and kicks it off even more. It's like a spark plug.
And NASA denies there's any connection.
They deny there's any connection. It's on the web. You can go to the NASA webpage and read their explanation, and it says, coincidence.
Jim, I know one of the things early on when in the Hale-Bopp saga, and gee, that was so unusual to have seen that comet so far out there. And one of the mantras that they repeated over and over again, NASA did, the big observatories did, they kept saying, it's not going to hit the Earth, it's not going to hit the Earth. Well, I never worried about that.
No.
But you say that comets can have a definite effect here on Earth, even though they don't hit the Earth.
Well, yeah, and take Hale-Bopp, for example, which was never came closer than 100 million miles from us. It may have been even farther than that away at its closest.
A little farther than the sun is.
Yeah. Now, we just came through a solar minimum, and we had more solar activity during the solar minimum than you have during most solar maximums. But there again, you have the specialists. Their rule of thumb is don't scare the public. Don't tell them the truth.
So we should have had what do you mean by a solar minimum?
Solar minimum, it's actually the minimum refers to the number of sunspots per day that form on the sun, and that number is a minimum, and it usually is related to low solar activity also. And then we're coming up to the year 2000, of course, where there's supposed to be a solar maximum, and the maximum refers to the number of sunspots, but historically the sun has also been far more active. And electrically, you know, of course, they don't have an explanation because they can't talk about electric fields in the proper circles.
Yeah, and your idea is a lot of this unusual solar activity is the result of Hale-Bopp and these other comets that we've hardly been told about.
Right, and we've seen the flares come off the sun in a 30-day cycle, and that's why we knew after the June 25th shutdown of SOHO, or the so-called shutdown, we knew that there were two comets in around the sun, and they were cycling. One is on about a 45-day cycle, and one is on about a 30-day cycle, and they were kicking off the sun when they'd come in, and they were on elliptical orbits. And that's why SOHO is so important, is because it's the only thing that can see anything that close to the sun.
But there's problems with SOHO.
Yeah, they keep taking it offline, so we can't see the data. But back to what was the thing we were talking about here originally?
Even though comets don't get anywhere near the Earth, they can have a profound effect on our weather, in fact.
Yeah, and here's the situation. You have the comet, which is electrically attached to the sun. Okay, it's a discharge from the sun out to a distance beyond the solar system with a big comet like Hale-Bopp. Now, you have to understand that most comets are little, and they're only small localized discharges of this capacitor.
Yeah. But you say, by the way, you say even though Hale-Bopp, the actual nucleus, was still a lot smaller than the sun, they lied about how big that thing was, didn't they?
They said 25 miles. Our current estimates from it going out of the solar system right now are about 1,400 miles
That's 1,400-mile wide nucleus.
Yeah, that's a new planet. Hale-Bopp is a new planet. There's a frame that actually, I don't know why they released it, because they, of course, these astronomers are getting older, and so I think some of them don't see too well anymore.
But, you mean one slipped by that wasn't supposed to be seen?
Yeah, it was taken out of South America, and I think last spring, but it showed a very nice volcanic plume coming off the surface of Hale-Bopp's nucleus.
So Hale-Bopp was nearly the nucleus, nearly the size of our moon.
That's right.
A planet that had active volcanoes.
That's right. And it's very hot, and that's why the very large array data relative to the nuclear temperature, the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, that's why it's classified.
No. My good, you know, and you seem to think they took a lot more pictures than they told us about.
Well, we know they did. I just want to summarize one last thing regarding to the how the comets work, Chuck, and then we'll go on to that.
Sure.
In the scenario of how the comet works, the comet now is discharging the solar capacitor, and there's a very subtle property of currents that occur in outer space, in free space, or what we call plasma environment of outer space. And that is that the electrons have much lower mass than the protons and the ions and the dust particles, which are positively charged generally. And so the bulk current of this discharge is in the form of electrons coming out from the negatively charged sun, outbound, and going out through the comet nucleus. And so the comet nucleus is the center point of this discharge. So you have a very high energy beam of electrons coming into the nucleus from the solar side. And it passes around the comet nucleus and it continues out. And then what it does, though, is that, like putting a rock in a stream, there's a pressure that builds up, and it's an electron pressure. So the nucleus of the comet becomes negatively charged and drags in all of this positively charged stuff from beyond. So that's the comet tail, and that's why the nucleus of the comet is able to drag this stuff in.
One of the things I know that Hale-Bopp was giving some of the scientists problems with is it kept changing its orbit a little bit.
Well, that was very interesting, because when Hale-Bopp first came out, Brian Marsden, who is the Smithsonian, and his job is to calculate and tabulate orbits.
He is like Mr. Comet. He's the guy when you discover a comet, you call him, right?
You call Brian.
Uh-huh.
And except when we discovered a comet, he refused to acknowledge it and gave it the credit to the SOHO people.
Oh, that's the one you spotted on the SOHO observatory place.
Yeah, and for 3 days they didn't release the information, and we saw it and claimed discovery of it, and they said, well, no, this has to go to the team that owns that satellite. And we said, excuse us, I think we're taxpayers, we paid for that satellite.
Well, that's the thing that's so upsetting. We paid billions and billions of dollars for this equipment.
Yeah.
And not only NASA, but apparently NASA is able to exert the muscle on some of the world's major observatories, so they keep their stuff secret too.
Well, if you want to play in this game, you got to deal with NASA and the because they hold the big money. And if you, like I found out myself, if you stand up and say, excuse me, King has no clothes, or if you say, like Oliver did, could I have some more porridge, you're out of there. And they wheel you out of there that day.
Yeah. Back to comets and the electrical phenomenon. And what does this do to things here on Earth?
The comet is discharging to the sun, a big one like Hale-Bopp, or these two small ones that are very encircling the sun, very close range. The electrical currents are coming up through the solar atmosphere and out. And so you have, now this goes back to our standard solar model. Now, if the heat of the sun were generated in the center and it just flowed out over a million year period, it would be very equal and very evenly distributed all over the surface. And this is not the way the sun is.
Oh, okay. So in other words, if their current theories on fusion, if they were correct about the sun, we wouldn't see sunspots, we wouldn't see solar flares, we'd just see a nice, evenly glowing, smooth,
right.
Smooth ball.
Right.
But we see a lot of weather on the sun.
Yeah. Yeah, and so the bottom line is that the sun's activity is occurring high in its atmosphere, and there's many reasons for believing this. And now the main cause of fusion is a hydrogen atmosphere, helium hydrogen atmosphere, with electrical discharges occurring in the atmosphere. Now there's a textbook problem on this, and it's something you learn in a good school as a sophomore in college, that you can create enough pressure to cause a fusion reaction with a bent current sheet. If you take two poles, put a cell in the middle with hydrogen in it, or helium, and you send the current down there so that it bends, so that the current bends. It's in those bends, it's called a pinched current, and what happens is the magnetic pressure in those bends becomes great enough once you get up to about 1,000,000 amps to kick off the fusion reaction. And so this is what the sun is doing. And a very interesting experiment was done by...
So it's not, as we've been told, the enormous gravity of the sun that got so hot that it kicked off the fusion. You're saying it's an electrical thing that kicked it off.
Yeah, and that's why Jupiter and Saturn exhibit star-like properties, because small things, they have those large electrical storms in their atmospheres and at a low level of fusion.
So the sun is not this glowing, reacting thing to the core. It's the atmosphere of the sun that we're seeing all the light and activity
in. Right. Now, you got to understand that we have been able to build nuclear bombs. I have not personally done this. I saw in the sense we, but I mean the scientific community. This is one of the things that solidified that concept so much, is because you can take and build a bomb on that principle, and it works, you know, on the principle of high pressure. And, you know, that's where plastic explosives came from, because they needed oxygen-free explosives to reside inside of those highly dense metal containers to compress this material to make a bomb. You
know? It's amazing.
It works.
It's amazing how inventive they are in the field of weapons, isn't it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, that concept does work, and that's what solidified this concept in their minds of how the sun works. But the problem is I wanted to mention an experiment that the Soviets did only a year or two ago. And as you know, we have some very high-powered Soviet scientists publishing on our webpage.
Right, right.
And I just want to throw a little mention of something also. They have taken my papers and recognized them, the papers that were printed in the late 70s and the ones I was thrown out of Cornell for trying to publish, and they have translated them, and these papers are now being taught in Russia.
Isn't that great?
And so,
I mean, it took 20 years, but God bless the internet. I think we are indeed coming into a day and age when secrets are being harder and harder to be kept.
Pretty hard to keep a secret these days.
That's the good thing. But I am stunned at how many secrets they're keeping.
Yeah. Let me
two new planets in our solar system are being kept a secret.
Right.
That's astonishing.
And actually, there's the other one. And now, this is the reason for the SOHO satellite to be shut down. They were getting very strange data as far as the currents, the solar wind, and things like that at SOHO. And it originally was sent up there to help us determine Earth weather, you know, relative to solar wind and things like that.
Right.
And for a while, nothing was making sense. And all of a sudden, this round object appeared right out in front of SOHO, and we were seeing trailings of it, kind of like plasma currents moving across the field out there where SOHO is looking at the sun. We were going, what's this? And we'd write to NASA and say, what are these things? Can you guys explain them? Then we'd never hear back, of course. Of course, NASA really means never a straight answer. And of course, we'd never hear back from them, and all of a sudden, we saw it. And that was the day they shut down SOHO, because we trapped the one picture that came out, and that's the day they shut it down.
And then, the site shut down mysteriously.
And we call that the Orca. It's a small planet that's locked in orbit right where SOHO lives, in that it's a little gravitational well about 1,000,000 miles out from Earth. Now, so that gives us what we believe, and now I have to make this clear.
Excuse me, Jim, do you have some idea of, I mean, how big a planet are we talking about here?
Well, it's round, it's perfectly spherical, and therefore it had to be molten at one time so that the self-gravity pulled it into a sphere. So it has to be significant. It's not a little asteroid.
Yeah.
But one thing I have to be clear about here, too, is that we cannot make public announcements that definitely there's something in these three places. We know there's something. We don't know the whole story, and NASA's hiding the data. So, and none of us have the equipment handy to check this out. So we don't know.
Is there anything, I mean, you say NASA's hiding the data, and I've heard that from lots of people, that they hide stuff. What can people do to someday get this data out there, do you think?
As long as we're on the radio and your location, I think there's probably some technicians someplace that have seen this stuff and have been told to shut up, and that if they had enough inner fortitude, they would come forward and say, yes, this came through, and it would at least get it going.
Yeah.
Of course, we've gone to Congress. We've made pleas. In fact, the Florida Today, the website that publishes NASA news releases, put Earl Crockett and my plea letters in there for a congressional hearing on this, and we never heard from a single congressman. And every congressman saw that.
Well, they're more interested in Monica Lewinsky, Jim. That's the thing that is so maddening.
Yeah.
There's big things going on. There's a history to our solar system. There's a whole different science. It's like I said when we began, everything we know is wrong. And I think that's largely the case. And when we're being inundated by our media with just trivial stuff.
It's pathetic what the media has done for science. The only scientists today, they used to have open news conferences at NASA, and they would even release the tapes as part of the ongoing NASA, PR program. But now, to get into a NASA news release, you have to be invited in. In other words, you have to be a news agent that's going to ask the right question.
Oh, that's like the White House is.
Yeah.
And I'll never get invited in there. I know that for sure.
But even there, when they have the president up there and they have the news, reporters out there, and they're asking them the tough questions, you know, that's way better than what goes on with NASA.
Really?
Oh, yeah. With NASA, it's a controlled, extremely controlled news release. They let out what they want to let out, and the reporters take that information and they can write it based on an official NASA news release.
And Jim, I know you think part of the thing that's being covered up has direct bearing on the very history of mankind.
Yeah, and the weather that we've had in the last year, you asked about Hale Bopp and the weather, and this has to do with the history that kind of leads into that. The weather we have been experiencing on Earth, the super typhoons, 5 hurricanes in the Atlantic at one time, one of which came across and caused more damage than any hurricane ever, killed hundreds of people, and then came through Central America.
Yeah, you're speaking of Mitch.
And killed tens of thousands of people and basically decimated an entire country or two. And now, the other thing you'll find on our webpage, which we don't have a lot of time to go into here, but these electrical currents, you got to understand the Earth is very well shielded in the solar system by our magnetic fields. We have 5 layers of magnetic fields shielding us from the sun. And when the sun kicks up, though, what happens is the currents can come through, and it's a very complicated set of plasma interactions between currents and magnetic fields. But basically, those currents can come in and build up our ionosphere, and it's the discharge from the ionosphere to the planetary surface that causes these huge storms. And now, this is why Hale Bopp, which has been pumping up our sun little bit by little bit over the last 6 years, is responsible for the weather we're seeing. So now, if you think comets are dirty snowballs, you just laugh at the idea that some comet that's going out of the solar system could have any effect on our weather.
And this is now this is really nothing nothing new. I mean, for centuries, people have noted that comets change things here on Earth, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. But don't tell that to NASA. They know better.
So you really feel our weird weather is the result of Hale-Bopp and these other comets?
Yeah, and the fact that the sun is pumped up electrically from what it normally would be. So the weather systems we've seen, and like the tornadoes we just had in January, we set a record in January 1999 down south for the by a factor of three, and this isn't even the tornado season, by a factor of three, the number of tornadoes that formed in 1 month, something like 179 tornadoes, came across the southern U.S. in January, killing hundreds and hundreds of people and wreaking incredible damage. And these storms are being powered by the currents that come from the ionosphere down to the surface of the Earth. Now, you can see the cells building up and unloading the currents from the ionosphere. Now, you were asking about historical perspectives. We are convinced, and I am convinced, that there was a dramatic Earth-changing event, and it was caused by a comet, and it was very recent in mankind's history.
Yeah, recent's a relative term. Give us a approximate there.
The approximate date, and it's hard to estimate, but from what, in fact, the Egyptians told Solon, which was a Greek that went back to ancient Egypt, we believe that the date was somewhere around 4,000 B.C., or 2,000 B.C., 4,000 years ago. And that, oddly enough, that was a period of time when Hale-Bopp...
I was just going to say, that was the last time Hale-Bopp was around.
Right, but Hale-Bopp was not near Earth at that time. But what was the companion that came in with Hale-Bopp, another companion, and an object which we believe formed the planet Venus. And now... This, if you look at Venus...
Venus, that would mean Venus has only been around about, 4,000 years?
Yeah, if you look at Venus as a planet, and a number of scientists have done this, independent scientists, not people with an axe to grind, but people with an independent view took Venus as an object and looked at it objectively and said, how old is this thing? Now, you have to understand, Venus's surface is plastic. There are no... continental shields, there are no the volcanoes rise up on Venus and they sink down into themselves. Venus is a highly molten planet.
Even though it's about the same size as the Earth.
It's a little bit smaller, yeah.
Yeah.
And the atmospheric pressure at the surface of Venus is enormous and it rains sulfuric acid out of the clouds.
Man. You know, it's a lot different than it is here.
Yeah, and the surface temperature is 900 degrees. Now, this is not due to a greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect was created by our friend Carl Sagan, and it was done because when they went to Venus, they actually expected to see plant life or possibly dinosaurs or some primitive form of life down there.
Really?
Yeah. And they got there, and it was, 900 degrees, hot enough to melt lead on the surface. And the Russians told them all along, says, hey, this is not Earth-like up there in NASA. Of course, they were poo-pooing the Russians. And they claimed that Venus would be an Earth-like place. And, of course, as with everything else that happened, NASA was using theories that were developed prior to the space program. And they still are holding on to those same theories. And time after time after time, when the data came in, they created new theories, in this case the greenhouse effect, to account for what was unexplainable.
Jim, I know, Jim is so fast. I know in future shows we're going to be talking about the Big Bang. That didn't happen. And you have some really fascinating things I know to say about Mars. Mars being... Well, you think there's signs of an old civilization up there, right?
Well, the Japanese sure think so, because they built a spacecraft in record time and sent it up there. It's on its way right now.
Yeah, and relatively unannounced, we launched two spacecraft in the last part of 1998.
Right. But
they announced the other day we're going to send an airplane to Mars. I mean, what is the big race up there?
Well, here's the situation in a nutshell with Mars. And we knew this when the first data came in a long time ago. They were expecting somewhat of a moon-like place up there. And they knew there was weather, there was, atmosphere. But what they didn't expect were rivers and oceans like Olympus Mons, which is the huge volcano, one of three on the surface of Mars, which you can see from Earth, actually.
It's the biggest volcano in the solar system, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
And at its base, just like the Hawaiian Islands, it's eroded on one side from ocean currents. You see very well-developed, winding, meandering riverbeds on Mars with the water gone. Now, if this happened millions of years ago, given the dust storms that we know occur on Mars, these would be eroded, but they're fresh as a daisy.
So the destruction of Mars, the oceans and all that, happened pretty recently, huh?
That happened very recently. And the other indicator is the cratering. If you had an atmosphere or a planet that did not have it changing, that's why you don't see this stuff on Earth. You know, you see the remnants of things that are relatively recent in terms of cratering, but they're covered over, there's bogs over them, you know, there's
vegetation
and they're hard to see. And we certainly don't look like the moon, and that's our next nearest neighbor, you know, and that's just pockmarked. There's craters upon craters there.
Right.
So the bottom line is that if this had happened to Mars a long, long time ago, like NASA wants you to believe, then there would be cratering, and cratering on top of the riverbeds and, you know, things like that. But no, it is very recent, extremely recent. And it's interesting to note that there are historical records of a comet which came by Mars and did not crash into it, but it was seen to literally suck the oceans and atmosphere off of Mars. And now, what is a comet?
Really?
A comet's a giant vacuum cleaner.
Yeah.
And if it comes close enough, now here's the interesting thing, and that's why you have to take things into context. Because once that plasma connection is made, there's going to be a free flow of plasma between those two objects, but the gravitational field comes into play then, because now you have the electrical fields neutralized, or equalized, I should say, between the two bodies, so the one that's going to win is the one with the higher mass.
Right.
So that says that the thing that sucked off the atmosphere of Mars was bigger than Mars. We also believe that same object, which became Venus, came near Earth and caused an incredible pollution event and a weather event on Earth, and drove us into what is an ice age, which we are just now getting out of. We're on the very tail end of it, and that's what we're seeing. We're not seeing global warming. We're seeing just the tail end of a trend of cooling or warming up from this ice age that the Earth was thrown into when this comet came by 4,000 years ago. It didn't strike Earth. It just came by and caused a lot of damage. But when it went by Mars, Mars lost its atmosphere and oceans. And if you look at Venus, which is slightly smaller than Earth and has a smaller surface gravity, Earth sucked a lot of stuff out of the comet, causing a tremendous pollution event here, a lot of it being oil. Now, the one thing I do want to comment here about is that the story of how oil formed is totally bogus.
You mean it's not fossil fuels? It's not old dinosaurs?
No. How did the fern forest grow under the ocean to cause the oil that's in offshore regions? And now you could say, well, the Earth looked different then. Well, how did the Earth just kind of maneuver all of this land around, move it up and down at certain times? The bottom line is that the oil was formed as an essential part. The hydrocarbon combinations, the chemical combinations, formed when Earth itself was a comet forming as a planet. And also, more recently, when this large comet came by, and you have, if you believe the Bible, and I think there's a lot of people out there that do, the stories in the Bible, the very beginning of the Bible, talks about the great flood. Well, what's the comet? Water.
Water, yeah.
Where'd the water come from? It came from the earth sucking this water off of the comet. And the water came off of the comet, and like I said, the earth was able to take a lot, drain a lot of that out of the comet because of its higher gravitational mass once the electrical fields were neutralized. And the other thing it did is it pulled in a tremendous amount of hydrocarbons. And the ancients talk about that. Every ancient civilization talks about brimstone and fire, the burning naphtha coming out of the sky.
Wow. And they talk about, not only do they talk about it as something happening in the past, but something that predictions almost of the future things to come like that.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, and if you look at Christ's Sermon on the Mount, they asked him, what's the future going to be? How is this earth going to end? How are we going to end? And he said, well, it happened before. This is what happened. You have to remember that Christ was educated in Egypt as a little boy.
Yeah.
And so he knew the famous event where he was in the church, the weekend that Mary and Joseph went to the, they were back in the Mideast. And Jerusalem, and they went for a weekend in the temple, a retreat, and Mary thought that Jesus was with Joseph, and Joseph thought he was with Mary, and they got together at the end of the weekend, and they said, where's our kid? Well, he had spent the weekend in the back room teaching the principal what would you call them? The high
teachers, high priests, yeah.
And they were going, where does this kid get this information? So at age, a very young age, or was he 12 at that point? I forget.
Something like that, yeah.
At a very young age, he was a very well-educated little boy.
That's what I heard. In fact, I heard he was also a musician. I heard the most amazing thing, that Jesus invented the F sharp.
No.
There's a lot of things we don't know about the life of Jesus.
That's right. But the bottom line here is when at the Sermon on the Mount, when the people asked him, what are the end days going to be like? And I suggest you go back and read your Bible. And what it says is that the moon will turn to blood. Now, what does that mean? Volcanic flows? Red?
Pollution? Yeah.
And that the stars will seem to fall from the sky, meteor streams.
Yeah.
The firmament will be shaken. And it was. Mountains formed.
In the news recently, we've heard a lot about meteors, green fireballs, and what have you. Are we seeing the tail end, no pun intended, of Hale-Bopp yet?
There's a lot of stuff out there, and to associate any given item with something else is very difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
But I must say that Hale-Bopp has left its mark on our solar system, and I might add that when it came in, it had a 4,200-year period of revolution in the solar system, and now it has a 2,600-year period. In the one course of its orbit in through the solar system, its orbit was cut almost in half.
And what slowed it down?
Well, that's part of the comet also. And there again, I love it. When Hale-Bopp was first discovered and they said, oh, this is 25 miles across, a huge comet, Brian Marsden came out on the web in writing and said there will be absolutely no perturbation of this comet's orbit because its nucleus is so large.
And it wandered all over the place.
And every day they had to update the orbit.
Yeah.
And then he got on, he said, oh, that's, of course, due to all this jetting that's going on, the jets that come off of the comet nucleus.
Well, little jets wouldn't move a big ball like that around.
And they said themselves, their own theory claims that it shouldn't, but they, there again, NASA can say anything it wants because it's holding the reins of the publication and the news media.
Yeah, they are the high priests.
Yeah.
They are the high priests.
So Hale-Bopp is a permanent member of our solar system. It's a new member. It's a new planetary member. And it's doing exactly what comets are supposed to do. It's becoming a planet.
And it slowed down from 4,000 years to 2,000 years. What, it'll likely slow down again and again and again?
Well, it's continually slowing down, and the reason in the comet, in my comet model, is that we call it the plasma discharge comet model, is that the tail drag, this electrically charged nucleus, is dragging in this tail. That tail drag slows it down, and it does two things over a long period of time. It will change the comet's orbit and slow it down. And what that does then, it causes the comet to fall into a lower orbit with a shorter period. And the other thing it does is it will circularize the orbit. These are classical celestial mechanics results of the tail drag. And that's part of the theoretical work that you'll find on the Millennium Group webpage if you read my papers. It goes through this entire process of how solar systems are formed and all of the effects that you will see based on this type of comet planetary development. And it goes into the statistics of solar system formation. And it talks about the encounter type of scenarios that occur. And I want to make the point clear that a comet does not have to crash into Earth to cause an effect.
Just as we saw with our strange weather now, right?
Right. And if Hale-Bopp would have come close to Earth, we would have had a tiger on our tail, so to speak.
And to quote you from a few minutes ago, things of biblical proportions, huh?
And that's very true. And if you see and understand that our weather systems are powered by electrical currents coming down from the ionosphere, the weather systems that would occur on Earth if Hale-Bopp would have come nearby, and I'm talking like four times the distance to the moon, which it would have if we were only 3 months earlier in our orbit.
Wow.
Now, Hale-Bopp's orbit is perpendicular to the plane of the rest of the planets. But when it crossed the ecliptic, which is the plane that the Earth's orbit sets in around the sun, it was a mere 1 million miles beyond Earth to the outside, which meant we would have been sitting right in that powerful comet's electron beam coming off of the sun, and yes, we would have had serious weather complications.
Absolutely. Amazing.
The other thing is if it were moving that fast, we would have actually had tides due to its gravitational field. And now you have to understand, 1 million miles would be four times the distance to the moon.
Right.
And so we would have a lunar-sized object with an incredibly large electric field and current sheet passing by, and we would be right out in front of it towards the sun. And that's what would have happened if we would have only been 3 months earlier in our orbit. We were 3 months farther in our orbit, and it was a non-issue. But the question I have, and NASA has the data to tell us this, and it's a non-issue for us because we'll all be dead, but in 2,600 years when that thing comes back, it's where's Earth going to be?
It's amazing. Almost every week there is new evidence discovered of a fantastic, incredible civilization that covered the Earth. I mean, I've seen pictures of the pyramids off Okinawa. There's pyramids in China, the great pyramids in Giza. There was just one hell of a civilization here on Earth. Was it something like a cometary event like this that took it down?
Yeah, and the Egyptians, it's very clear, like I say, Solon, who was Aristotle's uncle, went back to Egypt and said, okay, guys, because the cults, the priest cults, were still in existence in Egypt. And he said, what happened back then? Where did we come from? And they said, Greece, you are but a baby. The people who spawned your race that lives today were people who survived this natural catastrophe, and they were living in caves in the mountains in Greece. They're the only people that survived. And at that time, you were in a war with Atlantis. Atlantis was a continent outside of the Straits of Gibraltar, from what they stated. And there was an immense war going on, and Atlantis was in a very advanced nation at this time. And the Greeks were winning, is what the Egyptians told Solon. And he said, at that time, you know, the sky fell, the other shoe dropped.
Yeah.
The Egyptians, they told him also, they said, this has happened 10 times to us, or 5 times to us, in the last 10,000 years. Every time we get up and really get going, one of these things comes by, and I'll make something very specific here, too. The Hopi Indians tell the same tale, And they are very specific that it's a comet, and they are even specific enough to say that it's the blue comets that are the dangerous ones.
The blue comets.
The blue comets. In other words, that electrical discharge through the comet is so intense that it lights up like a light bulb.
Wow.
The blue ones are the dangerous ones. Hopi Indian.
Man, there is just so much. If it would blow, I guess it's true. It would blow our mind if we knew what was really going on. The whole picture, wouldn't it, Jim?
Absolutely. If the space program were run, if they let me run the space program, first of all, the first thing I would do is release all the scientists from all the heavy-handed pressure they're under, so they could come out and be what they really want to be, and that's a scientist, a person who's investigating and doing experiments and letting the experiments provide the results that confirm or deny theories, and not popular vote by the people who happen to hold the reins on the funding.
Yeah, it seems like they're guarding the old stuff instead of letting the new discoveries out.
Yeah, that's the first thing I do. And then I would take about a month time period, and I would take every program within NASA, and that includes the military stuff that's done at Goddard Space Flight Center in Los Alamos, and I would require that they redesign the satellites to accommodate and to analyze the data the way we know it should be, and that includes the electric fields. And I would just, I would have to say, we would have to have a very large conference so that the scientists who are now totally befuddled by what's going on could sit down and listen to what, you know, the order of things as it really should be, and start investigating this in earnest and quit putting it out as a ghost in the closet that nobody can talk about.
Yeah, and it's not only knowledge. We're talking about discoveries here that could really help conditions here on Earth.
Absolutely, and the thing is, we have, since we know how hurricanes and tornadoes form, you'll find this also on our webpage, we've developed methods, and we may not have the best method, but we have worked on the methods to dampen hurricanes and cyclonic storms, because if you can drag the current out from the main current sheet, you can dampen those storms and lessen their effect.
Wow.
And yeah, they're very important things that have very important effects on the daily lives of people around the world. You have to understand, there's now 6 billion people in the world. Literally half of them are living hand to mouth. This past year, the numbers were staggering. Cyclonic storms coming in off the ocean in India made 33 million people homeless.
Oh, my God.
In our own, we don't really recognize it until Central America. 10,000 people dead.
Dead and hundreds of thousands homeless.
Yeah.
Just staggering.
So to ignore this any longer is, I would say, criminal.
Yeah, especially in light of the fact that we apparently somebody on this planet knows how to do something about it.
Absolutely.
Jim, it's been a fascinating hour or so here. We will be doing more interviews. I've talked to Jim about a variety of astronomical and earthly things, and I'm looking forward to having many, many, many more conversations with you in the near future.
Well, thanks, Chuck, and I appreciate your time, and I just want to say that how important I feel it is to get this information out to the public, and that's what you're doing, and I applaud you for that.
Thank you, Jim.